it's now my great pleasure to introduce United States Senator for New York, Kirsten Gillibrand.
Hi, everybody. It's such a pleasure to be here. Well, thank you for the lovely introduction, Jean. I'm so grateful that you're serving as our moderator today. I also want to thank President Satish Tripathi for who couldn't be here today, but for his leadership and all the work that's done here at UB. I also want to thank the University of Buffalo Student Association for putting this together, and Anissa Evelyn, the Vice President of the UB Association's here. Anissa, stand up. Thank you. I also want to recognize any elected officials in the room. Are there any electeds here today? Yep, stand up. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it very much. So I really love being here for this town hall because I think our democracy only works when regular people stand up and demand action. And one of the best things I get to do as senator is travel around the state, hear from my constituents, learn what's on your minds, learn what issues you think are most important, and be able to offer ideas, solutions, and conversation about what needs to be done for New York. And as I've traveled around the state, the number one issue I keep hearing about is access to basic health care. People are very worried about having the coverage they need or being able to afford the kind of health care they need because of pre-existing conditions, because of concerns they have about their future, and just plain old affordability. And so one of the reasons why I've been fighting for Medicare for All is I really believe that if you had a not-for-profit public option, you would be able to get less expensive care, you'd be able to take on the drug companies, make sure that Medicare could buy in bulk, get cheaper prices, but you also could basically get universal coverage that's affordable for everyone. And so that's why I think we have to work, because I think healthcare is a right, it's not a privilege. And so that's why it needs to be available. The other issue I hear a lot about is the economy, and that a lot of people still find that they can't make ends meet. No matter how hard they work, they can't seem to find their way into the middle class. They can't seem to figure out how to get the part of the American dream that they always imagined they could. And the truth is that we need to do better by our manufacturers, by our farmers. We need to invest in job training. We need to make sure that our state schools and our SUNY schools have the resources they need to offer the exact coursework for the jobs that are available in the region. We want to see Made in America, so we have to invest in our manufacturers. And I think those are some of the proposals that I've been working on in Washington. In our most recent defense bill, I was able to get a provision in to encourage Made in America, helping regions come up with strategies for investing in manufacturing, and also a bill to allow us to employees to own the companies, to have more employee ownership of companies, more ESOPs and more co-ops. So those are just a couple of things that I think really affect Buffalo specifically, but New York State generally. Just access to those good paying jobs. And the last thing I just want to address is something that I think would make a huge difference for New York is getting the money out of politics. I think it's really important that we fight for publicly funded elections. And the reason I say that is anything that doesn't get done, it's largely because the special interests have put so much money into campaigns that they get their way. So when we can't take on gun crime, for example, it's because gun manufacturers spend so much money on campaigns giving money to the NRA that we can't do the common sense things like banning bump stocks or just making sure there's universal background checks, things that New Yorkers overwhelmingly support. When you can't, get healthcare costs down, it's because a lot of the insurance companies spend enormous amounts of money on these campaigns. It's drug companies spending enormous amounts of money on these campaigns, and they get an outsized influence. And so the truth is, we really do need to get money out of politics. And so I think that's something that we need to focus on as well. So I'm going to leave it there. And then any specific subjects, please bring up. We can have a lively conversation about all topics today. Thanks so much.
So let's get started. Let's start with the first three. So the first number 2291, the second number is 2290, And the third is 2325. So again, if your number was called, if you can come to the aisle. I'll repeat that one more time. 2291, 2290, and 2325.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Can you hear me all right? All right. Wow, a little bit shocked that I'm the first one to pick to ask you the questions, okay? Just to give you a little insight of who I am, my name is Glenn DiTullio. I live in the North Tonawanda area, work for the DOT. My wife and I had actually established an organization to help veterans, a whole new organization that's going to put the first of its kind veterans retreat centers around the country. So what our focus and our question for you is, what is your stand as far as getting that assistance to the veterans through tax-exempt organizations that are out there in New York? Secondly is, our focus is on the mental health awareness. Some of the issues is, like you had mentioned a moment ago about the pharmaceutical industries, you know, is where the health insurances will concentrate more on getting the pharmaceutical industry's financing through that insurance. And what is your stand on other options as far as like natural healing and the insurances?
Thank you very much for your question. I do support what you're doing right now. I think it's great that you are using a not-for-profit to support our veterans. A lot of our veterans, when they come out of service, particularly recent veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, unfortunately, they're having a tough time getting jobs that suit their skill set. In some places, young veterans have a 20% unemployment rate. So when we start declaring victory because there's a 4% unemployment rate, unfortunately, it doesn't count for a lot of groups that its unemployment rate is much higher, and one of them is young veterans. So some of the programs I think work with the best is job training, helping them figure out what skills they did learn in the military, translating it onto a resume, and then helping place them in industries where they will thrive. Veterans are amazing workers. Not only do they know how to show up on time, but they know how to work hard and never give up. And so you couldn't ask for a better worker given all the military training that a veteran has. And so we want to highlight that. We have a bill that I think we were able to renew that gives every employer a $1,000 tax credit every time they hire a veteran. That's just a small incentive, but it's a helpful incentive. And so there's companies around New York that really endeavored to hire veterans to not only get the tax benefit because they know it's the right thing to do. So I fully support what you're doing in your not-for-profit, and we do have resources that can go to you to help you be successful. And you should work with John Cardinal in my Senate office, who helps all New Yorkers apply for grants, particularly for not-for-profits who are trying to do good things by New Yorkers. So thank you. And then you had a second question about mental health and alternative therapies. I think we should be developing alternative therapies for a lot of issues. And mental health is one of the most important things to have access to. I was very worried in the last 10 years that I've been in Washington that we haven't invested enough in mental health, particularly in high school, colleges, and with our veterans. And active duty service members. And so I've put more and more money into mental health treatment in the last spending bill we just had. It's also a way to begin to address the opioid crisis. Not enough prevention, not enough treatment when they need it. And so I agree that we need more money on mental health and also more investment into alternative therapies that sometimes work very well for people. So we want to make sure all options for healing are on the table. Thank you.
So I will move on to the next three. So the numbers for the next three questions are 2295, 2316, 2315. If you are one of those numbers, please come to the aisle and a microphone will come to you.
Hi, Senator. I'm Amy. First thing I wanted to do is just thank you for your unwavering support of women's reproductive rights and abortion rights. I really appreciate it. My one question is around, as I work with healthcare reform projects with New York State Department of Health, and a lot of folks I talk to, they say we need a public option. They like the concept of Medicare for all, but the thing they're worried about is how we pay for it. And I know you touched a little bit about on that in your opening remarks, but I'd like to hear more about if you could build Medicare for all. What happens to folks who are getting their insurance from their employers? Could they buy into that system? And how do we afford it? I'm really interested in what you have to say on that.
Great. Thank you. So right now, healthcare costs are spiraling out of control. And there's a lot of reasons for it, but there's a couple places where I think you could cut costs. First of all, I would get the insurance industry out of the process, and I'll tell you why. Insurance industry are for-profit companies that have obligations by law to their shareholders. They have to deliver a rate of return for their shareholders every year. It's required by corporate law. And so when they're deciding, am I going to give you the second day in the hospital or am I going to give you access to this drug, they're not deciding based on what your doctor suggests or what is best to keep you healthy. They're deciding based on what's best for their bottom line. And so it's a misalignment of goals that is fundamentally harming the healthcare system in America today. So I would get them out of the process. I would create a not-for-profit public option. It doesn't matter if you base it on Medicare, Medicaid, something else, the VA even. You need to have a not-for-profit option so that people can buy in at a rate they can afford. So today, we spend trillions of dollars every year on healthcare, just trillions of dollars, every American just funneling to healthcare. You pay it in your co-pays, you pay it in your premiums, and you pay it in your deductibles. Every analysis of the cost of Medicare for all, the number they come up with is less than the cost of all the money we spend on healthcare today. So ideally, you would still have a system where you buy in, and perhaps your employer can help defray those costs and also buy in with you. So you both have a responsibility, so you're still getting it through your employer. But anybody could buy in, so that even if you're unemployed, even if you're underemployed, even if you aren't working at that moment, you still have access. And so you want universal access. You want the system to be not-for-profit, so there's no other diverging purpose. And you also have to take on the drug companies. The other place where costs are spiraling out of control is the cost of medicine. And it happens specifically in Medicare, because when they created Medicare Part D, they mandated that you couldn't buy in bulk. You couldn't get the lowest price like Medicaid does or the VA does or Canada does. And so that overwhelmingly hurts our seniors, and so they can't get the cheapest cost for drugs, which just continues to raise the rates of Medicare. So if you take those two things out, take the power of the drug company and the power of the insurance company out of the equation, you're going to have your money, whatever you spend on it, go directly to the care, directly to the hospital, to the provider, to the doctor, to the medicine. And that direct care is going to be cheaper, and it means everyone will be in preventive care, which means you'll have an ability to bend the cost curve because people are just going to be healthier longer, and you're going to really prevent a lot of cancers from developing, diabetes from developing, all these chronic illnesses, which are responsible for most of healthcare costs today is in chronic illness. So those changes, I think, bends the cost curves, makes it cheaper for everybody, and creates economies of scale. And so that's how I pay for it. So you basically buy in, but you're going to pay less. Let's just say the healthcare you spend every year is $5,000 a year, all in. You know, under this analysis, you're going to pay something like $3,500 a year. So it's going to be less in a significant degree based on all the analysis that's been done to date. So you're going to buy your healthcare just like you do today, but you're not going to pay an insurance company. Oh, one more thing. So the other part of that answer that needs to change to help us get there is today you don't know how much your health care costs. Nobody does. So if you go to the hospital and say, I really want an x-ray, how much does it cost? Well, if you're off the street, it's $5,000. If you're Medicare, it's $87. If you're Medicaid, it's reimbursed at $56 or whatever it is. It's going to be some random number. But none of those numbers are the cost of the x-ray. So to do this, to build this system, you would create transparency, 100% transparency in cost, so that eventually you can get to the right reimbursement rate for the hospital. Because any hospital, any doctor is going to say, I'm worried about Medicare for all because my reimbursement rates are so low under Medicaid and Medicaid, I can't make ends meet. Fair enough. you need to know what the real cost is, and we don't even know. So I would start the process with full transparency for healthcare costs so you know, like if there's two medicines that both do the same thing and one's $5,000 a month and one's $500 a month, you can choose the $500 a month one. You can have the generic. You don't need the fancy name. But unfortunately, the pharmacy benefit companies are, in some instances, committing fraud and doing paybacks to hospitals that will carry the brand name instead of the generic. Again, just putting more cost into the system. And so you just need to get all those layers out and just have the money go directly to the doctor, the hospital, the healthcare center, the provider, and then it's better. So that's how I envision it. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator. My name is Cody. I graduated right here from UB with a master's in urban planning and currently work at WEDI, the Westminster Economic Development Initiative. I know through my studies and some of the work I do now that a lot of what was important to Buffalo over the years to slowing a lot of the population decline and kind of helping to revitalize some neighborhoods, especially on the west side, were a growing immigrant and refugee population. And the work we do at WEDI, a significant portion of our clients are immigrants and refugees. So our question is, where you kind of stand on immigration policy and refugee acceptance, especially given current trends have kind of put a chokehold on a lot of that.
Thank you for your work. So this is a country that's been founded by immigrants. That's who we are. That's the nature of America. Our diversity as a country has always been our strength. Our diversity has really promoted and created entrepreneurialism, innovation, and a large economic growth trajectory. That's what immigration does in our country. We've never, ever, ever before this president been afraid of refugees or asylum seekers, ever, ever. We've never demonized immigrants the way this president has chosen to do. We've never demonized people who don't look like us the way this president has done, and it's harming America. The climate, unfortunately, around the immigration debate is toxic. President Trump, one of the first things he did was a Muslim ban. This country was founded on religious freedom. We believe that you should be able to believe in your God and worship any way you want. And so, unfortunately, that is where we are. The caravan specifically. This caravan, from what I can read, there's a lot of people coming from El Salvador, from Guatemala, countries that are rife with violence, rife with terrorism, rife with gangs, and a lot of them are fleeing and seeking asylum. This president has undermined the entire asylum process. In fact, he's demonized and criminalized all immigration to such a degree, if you come to our borders asking for asylum, you are immediately put in a for-profit prison system. Literally. I've met with women and children in a for-profit prison facility that came here seeking asylum because they were fleeing gang violence, rape, and murder, and all horrible things in their home countries. And they are hoping to have lawyers review their claim, have a judge review their claim. They are being given $2 a day to do manual labor in these facilities exactly the way we treat a prisoner, so that they can make phone calls to those lawyers and to family members who might live in the United States. It is outrageous. And so we need a real immigration system. We need an immigration system where you have real immigration judges, which right now we just have judges that are appointed by the Attorney General, are not appointed for life or appointed for a term, not elected, no oversight, accountability, no independence. And we don't have the infrastructure in place at all that would allow for people who are seeking asylum to actually get their claims reviewed in a timely manner. So that's why I believe that we need to reimagine how we do immigration in this country. We need comprehensive immigration reform, but we really need to have a value statement that we value immigrants and that we will give proper review for asylum seekers. We do not believe in open borders. Democrats don't believe in open borders. Nobody believes in open borders. But what we do believe is in a humane process. And the reason why is because what President Trump is doing at the border, separating mothers from children, is not only inhumane, but is immoral. And it is wrong, and we have never, ever, ever been afraid of immigrants or refugee seekers.
Thank you for your response, Senator Gillibrand. My name is Mackenzie Hafner. I work at Journeys End Refugee Services. It's one of the four local resettlement agencies here in Buffalo. And I had a question building on Cody's previous question. So right now in the news, you see a lot of publicity about the caravan coming up north, but also the separation of families happening at the border. There's another separation of families happening, and that is overseas. So as you know, there's been a lot of policy changes with this administration, specifically the travel bans, the one that was upheld in the Supreme Court, and also the additional extreme vetting measures that have really curtailed a lot of valid family reunification, and we see that at our office, having one of the only resettlement department to have a legal department within our agency. And so the question I have for you is, what specific policies are you supporting that will address this issue of family separation with families who have members in the United States, but then maybe they have a parent or a child or a sibling who's in a refugee camp or in the country that they fled to?
So are you talking about particularly refugees coming to the United States or refugees that are living abroad?
I'm specifically talking about refugees coming to the United States,
right.
The populations that are affected by the travel bans,
right.
And then the family members
who
of
are
people who
States.
Are already living in the U.S.
So one of the challenges, I went to one facility in New York. I went to go see Children's Village, which is a not-for-profit that is run by or funded by HHS. And this facility's been there for a long time, and it's changed who what type of child is there. But what's really disturbing is a lot of the children there now, some of them were unaccompanied minors, some of them were separated children at the border. They're not being given lawyers, and they're not being given the support they need to actually have a real asylum case. And because ICE has so become a deportation force, ICE agents are going to the homes of sponsors and interviewing everybody in the home to make sure no one has any immigration violations or any or lack any kind of paperwork. And unfortunately, that's scaring off the sponsors. And so these kids, a lot of them, might sit in these institutions. And from the outside, it looks beautiful. It looks like a college campus. But from the inside, not so much. When you go into the rooms, every room is the same. They have the same prison-like setting. There was, in this particular place I went, they had a stuffed animal on every dresser. The stuffed animals still had their tags on. They'd never once been played by a child. They'd never been once touched by the kids sleeping in those beds. And outside every bedroom was a chair. And I was like, what are the chairs for? Like, that's where security sits at night. So it's like being in a prison. It's not like being at a college campus. It's not like, and when they go into the community, they're not allowed to speak to any Americans. They literally, if they went to the movie, if they get a field trip once a month, they couldn't speak to somebody sitting next to them. Like, they're forbidden from engaging with American children. So we're treating them this way, like an incarceration setting. And the minute they turn 18, they call ICE and they deport them. So their whole experience in America, seeking asylum, coming to this country, is that the sponsor slash family member that might have taken them in any other administration, any other time, is now afraid to sponsor these children. If they're not given lawyers, their asylum claims aren't actually dealt with properly. If we don't have enough immigration judges, their claims will never be heard. And the day they turn 18, ICE is called and they are deported. That's wrong. That is one of the reasons why I think that ICE, its reputation is so destroyed at this point. They can't do their jobs. ICE was founded in 2003 to do anti-terrorism. It was founded after 9/11 with a specific mission, which is a really important mission. And because of this president and this administration and how they've turned ICE into a deportation force, those missions aren't being funded. And I have a letter from 19 ICE agents to the Secretary of Homeland Security asking to get rid of ICE specifically because their reputation has been so tarnished that local law enforcement and local communities will no longer work with them on their anti-terrorism missions, which is their most important mission. So making sure that we arrest and deport MS-13 members, making sure we stop human trafficking, making sure we stop drug trafficking and gun trafficking and other international terrorism and crime, ICE is being forced to be this deportation force, and all their money is going away from terrorism for deportation and for these for-profit systems, prison systems, which is sucking money out of the entire system. So that's why I think ICE needs to be entirely dissolved, reimagined, and put into a new agency so they can have a better reputation. That's exactly what these ICE agents have asked for, and I agree with them. So that's why our whole immigration plan needs to be redone and fixed. And I would move the anti-terrorism work into the Department of Justice so they can collaborate with the FBI, they can collaborate with local law enforcement, because those are the ones who track down the human traffickers, the drug traffickers, the MS-13 gang members. And I would do immigration entirely differently under a more judicial, humane system like the one we used to have under President Obama.
All right. The next three numbers, 2318. 2318. 2312. And 2310.
Hello, Senator. I'm a city councilman in the city of Niagara Falls, New York. I've been serving for 3 years now. And first, I just want to, you know, let you know that I thank you and commend you for all your great work, and just want to make myself available and accessible to you to help you in any thing that you're doing as far as serving the state of New York. It's a few issues that I'm personally working on with some of my colleagues. One of the issues is on the north end of Niagara Falls, we have a community center that has been shut down for approximately 11 years now. And I'm very passionate about looking to redevelop this community center to get it going again. For one, you know, the youth is at the center of my heart, just like I'm sure it's at yours. I believe that getting this started back up, it will help reduce some of the crime, also some of the teen pregnancy, and also many other issues. So, you know, just looking to prevent many issues and having the ability to have my office work with your office will be very helpful. Another issue, two issues, that revolves around transportation. It's around scoff law. I passed the resolution in Niagara Falls called scoff law reform. And what I'm hoping is that we can maybe practice some of the practices that I've seen in Houston, also in Washington, to where individuals that may have a ticket that they receive, that they have the ability, if they are not able to pay it off financially, they're able to work it off through community service hours, which can help out with preventing individuals that get scoff laws, and now individuals that can't pay for it, now it's a vicious cycle to where they're driving without a license, getting arrested, and now ultimately they can't provide for their family. So maybe, you know, taking some interest in that as well. And another issue recently is trying to get more representation on the NFTA Board of Commissioners from Niagara County. Currently, there's 12 members that's on the board. 10 of the members are from Erie County. 2 of the members are from Niagara County. I believe that we need to have more representation on that board so we can have a seat at the table. So just, you know, receiving some assistance.
Thank you for your public service, and thank you for working so hard for our communities. I really would love to help you on the Niagara Falls Community Center. There's a lot of federal money that can be used to invest in community centers. So I'd love to have you work with John Cardinal in my office about applying for grant money and maybe finding sponsors in Niagara Falls to actually help do that, whether we can get some of the local community colleges or the local hospitals to participate. That would be really helpful. And then on your dealing with the scoff laws, I think it's really important that we pursue the reform that you mentioned. I think doing community service would be an extraordinary benefit to the community and to the people who can't pay their violations. So I would love to work with you on that. Obviously, it's a local issue, but I'd love to help with advocacy. And I need to look into the Board of Commissioners. I don't know much about that issue, but certainly the perspective that you've shared sounds concerning to me. So let me look into it and see in what ways I could be of assistance. But I look forward to working with you and your office. Thank you.
Senator, up here.
Yes. Go ahead.
How are you?
Good.
My name's Todd Varick. I work for your local independent living center, and we serve people with disabilities. So I have two topics that are important to my community. One is actually a follow-up on the transportation question from the previous fellow, because paratransit services and services for people with disabilities are really at a crisis point. People with disabilities are being isolated in their homes because as NFTA reduces fixed route service, they reduce the corresponding paratransit service. So you've got people that are moving into places that can't get access to buses. Cars are not in their future based on the really small budgets for SSI and SSDI, and Uber and Lyft aren't accessible to people with disabilities. So that's the first question. The second is, what can you do to help us with the crisis in housing? The waiting list in Erie County for a Section 8 housing choice voucher stands at 11 years. You ask now, they'll get you in 2028. I got people with disabilities in nursing homes that would like to return home, but they can't because they can't afford the rents. And as the rents raise in the city of Buffalo because economic development is improving conditions, you've seen the report that says that last couple of years, rents have raised almost 30%. Well, the corresponding income for people with disabilities is not raising. They're not able to afford those rents. What can you do to help on these?
Well, I share your frustration with affordable housing. It's one of the biggest and most urgent needs all across the state. It's not just a problem here in Buffalo. People can't afford to pay their rent. And I think housing is a human right. I don't think it is should be a luxury. I don't think anyone in this country should be homeless. So I will work with your local representatives to get more money into Buffalo specifically for affordable housing. There are federal programs for affordable housing under HUD, but unfortunately President Trump continues to cut those budgets, which is very frustrating because there's not a community in America that doesn't need more affordable housing. But getting rid of the federal grants that provide it for seniors, for disabled, and for low-income workers is really a problem. It's unfortunately a value statement that this administration does not care about working poor or people with real serious needs. The Uber and Lyft thing is really troubling. They should be required to have a certain percentage of their stock in every city be disability accessible.
Identify, they do not.
Yeah,
they
I use, think that's outrageous. I'm going to look into how we can begin to regulate those two issues because that's not right. Part of the problem when you become a disrupting industry, when you disrupt all the rules of the road, you don't have the same safety and protections that are put in through regulation for older industries. And so you've highlighted a huge problem in my mind. So let me work on that with you specifically, because I think it's an unacceptable outcome. In terms of getting more federal money so we can have better transportation infrastructure here, I work on that every day, and that's what we constantly are trying to get more federal dollars into New York so New York can spend more money on infrastructure and making sure it's accessible. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Glenn Coe. First off, I want to thank you for the time you were in Buffalo recently that you sat there and had like a good 15, 20 minute conversation with me. My first concern is obviously the big push for the marijuana legalization. I noticed that you have a son about my son's age. Currently he's 15, but last year he comes home and sits there and tells me that a lot of the kids on his wrestling team are doing pot. Mm. So there's a big push for it, but how in the world are you going to keep it out of kids' hands when we're not doing it already?
Right.
From what I've read, our brains are developing until the age of 26,
correct.
Not 21.
Correct.
I'm myself a non-drinker, never had a drink in my life, and don't do drugs. And I try to teach that to my kids, but the problem is they're going to do what they're going to do.
Correct.
So there's also an increase in drug driving deaths in states like Colorado that have legalized it. So that's my big concern. And years ago, before my work accident, I was doing security. And people would be smoking it inside and didn't care about anybody else.
Right.
But my biggest concern, like I said, is my son.
Kids, yeah, me too.
The other is the kind of question I had asked you before, and I'm wondering if there's an update. We hear all the time about equality. And I had discussed with you about selective service. I have a son that turns 18 in January. He has to sign up for selective service. I have a niece that turned 18 this year. She doesn't have to. When Obama removed restrictions from women in combat, he nullified the 1984 Supreme Court ruling because there was restrictions. So I'm wondering if there's any update on that.
Thank you. So for the last issue first, I believe that everyone, every kid 18 should register for selective service. And I think it would be useful because if this country ever is in a grave time of war where everyone's needed, women and men have enormous skills to offer our nation's security. It would be absurd not to ask women and men to do whatever they can to protect this country if it was ever needed. And so that's why selective service should be gender neutral. And it should really be gender neutral. And I think what President Trump's trying to do to degrade transgender troops is disgraceful. Why gender idea should have any impact on your ability to serve and sacrifice for this country is ridiculous. And so I do believe it should be gender neutral, and I will work, and I've worked on the Armed Services Committee on a bipartisan basis to include women. So I'm going to keep doing that and to get it done. This president has not been willing to pursue that, and it does not support, even Secretary Mattis has said recently, I don't support women in combat. He said it in a way where he said, the jury's still out as to whether it's effective, which to me is he does not support women in combat because they have shown they're effective. They've shown they've been effective in the Rangers program. They've shown they've been effective in other special ops. And so we don't have an administration that wants to pursue gender-neutral selective service at this point, but that doesn't mean it won't be that way in the future. With regard to marijuana, I share your worries about our children. It was the reason I never really got interested in doing something on marijuana because I was just, I looked at it only as the lens of a parent saying, I don't want my boys to ever smoke pot because it does terrible things to your brain when your brain is developing. And that's just a fact. And it is up to 26, particularly for boys. Their brains develop up to 26. And if you smoke pot before you're 26, it rewires your brain and you are forever rewired in not a productive way. So very worrisome. But the issues of decriminalization are a bit different. I haven't seen any evidence of states that have done decriminalization that it's had an increase in usage by minors who are all, is illegal to use. So you still have the same rules as alcohol. In a state that's decriminalized like Colorado, I don't know what their drinking age is. Let's just assume it's 21. Their usage for marijuana is also 21. Kids get access to alcohol. Kids get access to marijuana, even though it's illegal for them to do so. Those laws aren't changing at all. And I don't think it's hard to get pot today, and I don't think it's hard to get alcohol today. So how do we solve your problem of how do we keep our kids safe? I think we just need to spend more time and attention on it. The one thing that stopped drunk driving was the Moms Against Drunk Driving movement. The fact that we had those ads on TV all the time about not drinking, I think really did prevent kids. It became socially unacceptable. I think it has to be socially unacceptable for kids to smoke pot. And maybe the way you do it is you do a real campaign, do some public service ads around it. I remember the ads when I was growing up of this is your brain on drugs, and it was a frying egg. Do you remember that ad? I remember that ad. I didn't want to try drugs. I was very afraid of drugs. But I think public service, maybe we can invest more in public service announcements for states. We should do it for all states, but especially states that are considering medical marijuana or full legalization. Just so kids do not think it's okay just because it's now legal, because alcohol consumption is equally as harmful on the brain as, I don't know medically, but I would imagine it's equally as harmful as marijuana on the brain of a developing child. So I think we just have to continue to talk about it at the kitchen table, and I think we have to put it into the culture that it's not okay. The other thing that really harms our kids and the driving issue is the distracted driving. So not just drug driving, but distracted driving. 11 kids, people die a day from distracted driving. It's the number one thing that the car insurance companies focused my efforts on like 4 years ago, saying this is a huge problem. So teaching kids, you got to put your phone away. You got to put it in your back pocket. You got to put it in your purse and don't touch it while you're driving, because the Facebooking and Instagramming and checking your emails while driving is the reason why kids are getting killed in car accidents these days. It's not necessarily drugs or alcohol. It's the distracted driving. So I think we just need to do more, and I don't think we've done enough. So I really do share your concerns because it worries me. The reason why I support decriminalization is because, unfortunately, marijuana laws are disproportionately enforced against people of color, and it's really egregious. In New York City, if you're black or brown, you are 10 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than if you're white. That's disgraceful. And all studies show marijuana usage is the exact same amongst all racial groups. So it's just we're locking up young black men and young Hispanic men disproportionately for marijuana possession. And when you are arrested for possession, it's even a small amount. If your mom's in public housing, you can't go to her house for Thanksgiving. You can't sleep over. You can never visit her. You might be denied job opportunities. You might be denied huge life opportunities. You're more likely to get arrested, and because you have that conviction of possession, you'll get that much more of a punishment for any other infraction. It's just enforced so disproportionate against people of color. It's just racist. It's unfortunately part of institutional racism. And so for me, that was the main reason that shifted me from just medical marijuana is okay to let's fully decriminalize. but I've not stopped being afraid for my own boys. So I share your fears. I just think we need to do a better job of making it known in society that it is not okay for kids ever to do drugs, drink, or text while driving, because all those are the things that kill them. So I share your fears and frustrations, and I will work hard to keep elevating it. And I yell at my boys every day, so.
So we're running close on time. These will be the last three questions that the senator will be able to take. And the numbers are 2323, 2306, and 2319.
Good afternoon, Senator. Thank you for spending a little time with us today. My name is Jeff Ampleman. I'm a graduate of the planning program here. I'm also an employee at the local transit provider. One of the big initiatives we're pushing right now is the potential extension of the rail line to the UB North campus. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on the future of public transit funding for rail extension projects and its ability to be used as an economic catalyst for the region.
I fully support it, and one of the things we've been trying to do on a bipartisan basis in Washington is just get more transportation dollars into New York. Unfortunately, we continue to underfund transportation infrastructure despite President Trump's promises that this was going to be his big thing. He's cut funding for all transportation budgets across the board and then added them all up again and said, I'm putting $1 billion or $1 trillion into it's less money than we had last time. So, unfortunately, we keep not getting the funds that we need, but the good news is it's a bipartisan issue. Most elected leaders in our state truly believe in transit dollars, mass transit, and funding our infrastructure because it's an economic growth engine. Having that additional transit line will help create more economic growth in this area. So I fully support it, and I'll work with local leaders to get the money to do it.
Hi, Senator. My name is Charlie Baxter. I work here at the university, and I'm particularly interested in getting more people who are not currently engaged in the political system or engaged with activism in their communities involved. So my question is, there are always differing views within political parties, but the extent to which a unified vision for the Democratic Party is both defined and effectively communicated to the public seems to be lackluster. I understand that there are many fights to fight on so many issues, especially all those that we've covered today, that all need our attention. But can you identify the three top-tier issues the Democratic Party should be focused on, how compromise can be achieved within the Democratic Party, and what you think are effective strategies for spreading that message to the electorate, but particularly voters who are potential voters or those who are not yet involved?
So the top three issues that I care about and that, frankly, I heard about no matter where I traveled in the state and no matter where I traveled in the country when I was campaigning for other candidates were really simple. Education, healthcare, and jobs. Top three issues, bar none. Democrats, I think, believe that we should care about one another, that, in fact, we are our brother's keeper and we believe in the golden rule and we should treat others the way we want to be treated. That's why we believe that healthcare should be a right and not a privilege. It's why we're working on ideas like Medicare for All or other not-for-profit public options to make sure that we have universal coverage that's more affordable and more accessible. We believe that education is the gateway to the middle class. That's why we focus on early childhood education, programs like Head Start, making sure college can be affordable, at least debt-free or free or near free. That's why we believe that anyone should be able to get the kind of training they need to get the job that allows them to work their way into the middle class, because we really believe that the American dream is for everybody. With regard to jobs, no matter where I've traveled in the state, people cannot make ends meet. There is so much difficulty in getting a job that pays enough to be able to earn their way into the middle class. And so to me, the solutions focus on job training, making sure you can have the exact training for the exact jobs, more employee ownership so we can deal with income inequality and more employees can have a piece of the pie and have a piece of control of the companies they work in. Making sure we actually have full employment as a goal, because it does matter. As we talked about earlier, young veterans might have a 20% unemployment rate. African-American males in an inner city might have a 10 or 12% unemployment rate. Young black women have maybe an 11 or 12% unemployment rate. There's real concerns about who's employed and who's not, but no matter who you are, whether you're in rural New York or in an inner city New York or a small city like Buffalo, most people feel underemployed or not earning enough wages for the what they need to meet their family's needs. And so that to me just means better job training and focusing on making sure people can get that job that allows them to provide for their kids. As you heard in almost all the questions asked, people really care about their kids. Our values are shared. It's all about what happens at the kitchen table. And so I really believe it's three simple things: healthcare, education, jobs. And the more we focus on our solutions around those core values, and the core value that we do care about one another, the Democrats will not only have a national message that resonates everywhere, but meets the needs of New Yorkers. Those are the things that I've heard most about as I've traveled the state. And I think that is happening right now. It's just that because it's a midterm election, people are in their own states communicating. So I did the Buffalo Ed Board today. And so in tomorrow's paper, I'm sure there'll be analysis of all these things I'm for. I'll get the front page. I can get the front page in Syracuse. I can get the front page in Albany or in Rochester. But I'm not going to be part of the national narrative about what this town hall was about. So it's not going to be heard as a national Democratic message because I'm not a national messenger. We don't have one when you have a president of a different party. So that's the downside of losing a presidential election, is that the president has a bully pulpit that no one else has. There's no Democrat who's on par. You have people who are perceived as leaders, but not necessarily as national leaders. So just a structural problem. But I think the message is, as I said, and no matter, I mean, I was campaigning in Tennessee for state Senate and state House candidates because I want more women to get elected. And they talked about healthcare, education, and jobs. I was like, wow, it is everybody's message. So it is. Those are the three top issues. Those are the three top issues people care most about. And it all focuses around the kitchen table and the fact that people want to be able to protect their children. It's the most important thing in life, you know, protecting your family. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for being here. Can you hear me?
Yep.
My name is Nate Drag. I work for an organization called the Alliance for the Great Lakes, and I live here in Buffalo. And thank you for coming to our end of New York State, where we have two beautiful Great Lakes, Lake Erie and Ontario, and thanks for all your hard work to protect them from threats like invasive species, microplastics, nutrient pollution, because they certainly need protection, because they're the source of our drinking water, of everyone in this room and our communities. And unfortunately, in recent years, there's been crisis in Flint, Michigan, Toledo, Ohio, and many other communities that have restricted people's access to safe and affordable drinking water. So my question has to do with what the federal government can do to work together with state authorities and local agencies to ensure safe and affordable drinking water.
Well, I do believe that safe, affordable drinking water is a human right, as is clean air. And that's why I've been most distressed when we have governors or presidents that don't believe in clean air, clean water, and are trying to undermine all the regulations that protect it. When they had Scott Pruitt as the EPA administrator, when he was Attorney General of Oklahoma, he sued the EPA more than a dozen times on behalf of polluters every time so they could pollute more. As EPA administrator, he just rolled back every environmental protection for clean air and clean water that he could find that wasn't written into law, that was just regulatory. The next administrator will intend to do the same thing, which is very harmful to New York. They're trying to undermine states' rights when it comes to states that have higher standards for drinking water and clean air. And we've been fighting against it tooth and nail. For the Great Lakes, we have a couple of risks. They're trying to let boats come into the Great Lakes that don't clean their hulls first, and they just spit out whatever water and whatever invasive species are in their hulls that have come from all over the world. And so we have a problem with Asian carp that is so frightening. If Asian carp gets introduced to the Great Lakes, I promise you they will eat and destroy all the local species. And so our fishing industry, our boating industry will be affected negatively, and our tourist industry, because a lot of these milfoil and other algaes, they're coming from the places where it is not consistent with our climate or our biology of our lakes, and so it can create algae all across the top of the Great Lakes. It could literally destroy the water quality, and it would affect our drinking water. I'm also worried about chemicals. One of the things that we have to worry about in New York State is that, unfortunately, we're the home to the largest Superfund in the United States. It's called the Hudson River because of PCBs that were polluted 100 years ago. We have a problem with TSCs. We have a problem with PFOA. PFOA is a chemical retardant for fire retardant that's used on our bases. I have to check to see if Niagara uses it, but they do use it at Stewart and they do use it at Gabreski, which is a huge problem because these PFOAs are cancer causers. And so in my county where I live, in Rensselaer County, St. Gobain's plastic maker used PFOAs in its manufacturing, and they leached these carcinogens into the groundwater. And so if you bathe your children in water in parts of Rensselaer County, it has high PFOA content. You've been bathing your kid in it for years. You have no idea if they're going to get cancer when they're 30 years old. You have no idea if you're at a health risk. So I'm really pushing for medical monitoring so that when these chemicals do leach into our drinking water, into our groundwater, that we hold the companies that made all the money by making these chemicals be accountable. And so I have to check out, I got asked about that today, so I have to see if PFOA is an issue here in Western New York too. But so I work really hard to have higher standards, make the EPA do their job despite this administration, and make sure that we protect our air and water. And we try to get a lot of funding. We got money in the defense bill to clean up PFOAs on these military sites this year. We have got some funding in the WERDA bill for Great Lakes restoration for these invasive species, and we're trying to get more money just to clean up our Superfund sites and our other toxic lakes and streams that we have in our state. So thank you for the advocacy work you do. It makes all the difference in the world, and I think people just have to understand it takes speaking up. Like, everything you care about, everything that was raised today, it's about raising our voices, making sure we vote, making sure we're heard, making sure that the people who represent us actually represent our values, and really holding folks accountable. So thank you for coming to this town hall. Thank you for raising the issues that you care deeply about, and thank you for your participation. It really makes a difference. Thank you.